Getting Zen with Gen Z, empowering, motivating, and inspiring you to live your happiest, healthiest life. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Getting Zen with Gen Z. I'm very excited to have my good friend, Dr. Joe Oliva, on the show today. He is a doctor of physical medicine and rehabilitation. He's been a doctor for 23 years, correct?
Unfortunately.
But the most amazing thing about Dr. Joe, and I think everyone in the Chicago jiu-jitsu community knows him as Dr. Joe, is that he's a first-degree black belt in jiu-jitsu.
Yes.
So welcome today.
I'm excited.
I really appreciate you taking the time out of your very busy schedule, I'm sure.
My pleasure.
So thank you for coming. But tell us a little bit, let's start out, we have a lot to talk about, but I want to know, what made you want to become a doctor?
My father forced me to.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't by choice.
No, it wasn't exactly a passion, but I'm glad that I chose it. But he very much emphasized education within the boys. And so my oldest brother is a physician. I'm a physician. My other brother's an attorney.
Okay. Yeah. So lawyers and doctors.
We got our bases covered.
That's amazing. Explain what physical medicine and rehabilitation
sure.
is.
That's probably the most common question I get asked.
Yes.
And even to this day, people I explain it to don't fully understand
it. Like, what?
I kind of don't understand it myself. No, so it's a relatively new specialty that probably came into existence after World War II when there was a lot of disabled veterans coming back from the war and they just had no idea what to do with them. But in a sense, it's broken down into two components, the physical medicine component, mm-hmm. which I'll get to in a minute. The rehab component is taking care of people with disabilities and trying to maximize their function. So
okay.
spinal cord patients, we do a lot of training in.
Mm-hmm.
Head injury, we do a lot of training in. Strokes, bread and butter, a lot of pediatric disabilities like cerebral palsy. So not only dealing with their medical issues, but dealing with them functionally. So we have a more holistic approach for these patients than mm-hmm. just, you know, a regular primary care doctor might do.
Right.
The physical medicine aspect is probably in the interest of the jiu-jitsu world because it deals with a lot of sports medicine. So we deal with sports medicine issues as opposed to an orthopedist. We deal with it non-surgically. So we try and take care of things through exercise if we can.
Okay.
Pain medications, which I know you and I are going to talk about, mm-hmm. various injections. So any sports injury, my particular passion is taking care of spine problems. So neck, mid-back, low back problems.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. And touching on the rehabilitation, I mean, I know having my grandmother, you know, in the hospital after her stroke and she went to Evanston and realizing that you practically run like the second floor of Evanston Hospital.
Yeah, we have a nice rehab unit there.
Yes, everyone was amazing. So thank you for that because they took amazing care of her.
Yes.
So that was
Yeah, it's
incredible.
One of the few inpatient rehab units that there are on the North Shore.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're very proud of it. And we work it hard at meeting the needs of our patients.
Yeah, absolutely. So what is your... what's the most common, I know you deal with a lot of spinal injury, but what does a typical patient look like? Like what kind of, I know with the spine, but what would they kind of come into you for?
Sure. So for me, I would say low back problems tend to be a little bit more common than neck problems. I don't know if that's proven in the research,
mm-hmm.
but most of the time it's, I would say the vast majority is some sort of wear and tear change that we all get
mm-hmm.
that comes to the surface because we're doing something in life that aggravated it.
Right.
So whether it might be a fall or whether it might be a sports endeavor or a work sort of injury,
mm-hmm.
I would say that's the most common. I would say second place would probably just be muscular pain. You know, we're all now working on computers.
Right.
And there's a blessing and a curse to that. And bad postures bring out muscular pains in a lot of patients. And then I would say probably tied for second is some sort of disc issue, meaning a herniated
yes.
disc and slash pinched nerve. They tend to run hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say those are the top three. Wear and tear changes, they use words like degenerative disc disease and spinal stenosis, which scares the crap out of patients.
Right.
yeah. And so I'm there to kind of lend some perspective to it and come up with a rehab course and again, try and lower the pain, maximize function, and get people back to doing the things that they really want to do. And that's my main focus.
Okay. And your goal is to kind of avoid surgery if
Definitely.
You know, yeah, if that's able to.
Yeah, that's my modus operandi. And it turns out that most musculoskeletal problems, meaning sports injuries, shoulders, knees, hips, as well as spine injuries, can be handled non-surgically. And that's really in the realm of 90% of them. Only about 10% to 5% go on to some sort of surgical procedure.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. Last week, I actually had my cousin who lives in Seattle, and she's a physical therapist. And she was kind of explaining the difference between PTs and OTs and kind of, you know, people coming in either pre-surgery or post-surgery, or, you know, getting referrals and working with doctors, obviously very closely, but that there are so many different things that you can do and work through. And a lot of times I think it's just, especially when it involves, I think, spinal injuries or even sports injuries, we do things that we think will help, but are just making it worse.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. No, I mean, the therapists are indispensable, both occupational therapists and physical therapists. And, and the other misconception on the part of not only patients, but even physicians themselves that are not in the field that I'm in, is that I'm going to go to the therapist and the therapist is going to make me better. And then when I'm done with therapy, it's back to business. And it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, no. They're like, yeah, I feel better. It's all good. Yeah. No.
No, it's what they teach you is really something that you need to incorporate, or you're going to be back to square one.
Right. It's maintenance. I mean, it's working it in is
no doubt.
Yeah. 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 For preventative reasons as well. So what are most of, I mean, obviously being in the jiu-jitsu community, you, I'm sure, get everybody like myself who's always turning to you for any medical issue. But what are some of the most common sports injuries?
Yeah, so in jiu-jitsu, I would say probably the top three, I would say, would be, I've been seeing a lot of people with knee problems. Meniscus is probably top of the list.
Okay.
And then the LCL, which is a ligament that runs on the outside of the knee, because we put our legs in that triangle position a lot. It puts a lot of stretch on that. I would say that's very common. And then ACL, I would say, is kind of third in terms of knee sorts of issues. I would say shoulders are pretty common, meaning rotator cuff issues, and the acromioclavicular joint, which is a fancy word for where the collarbone meets the shoulder itself, because we're constantly putting pressure on it and rolling on it.
Right.
And then I would say spine, meaning neck and lower back problems.
Okay. When do you suggest somebody comes in to maybe see you or see a doctor? I mean, I know we can get stubborn, especially athletes, I think, try and work through stuff.
Rub dirt on it.
Right. Just be like, it's okay. It's fine. Like, I can roll through it or, you know, take care of it. It's no problem. But, you know, what kind of signs are there when you should really kind of go see a doctor?
Yeah. So for the knee, the thing that worries me, I mean, if it's not getting better, you got to see someone. Mm-hmm. That's the bottom line. But the knee in particular, if there's swelling that you can notice right to left or left to right, depending on which knee you injure, that really is something that needs to be looked into. So if you notice that the knee is larger on one side from the other side. So I want to see that person relatively quickly.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the shoulder, the thing that probably worries me most, which I think is easy to see, is some sort of disfigurement where you see things are not looking on the right like they do on the left,
or vice versa.
Or, with a rotator cuff injury, sometimes you'll just lack the ability to move that arm. So, so those are people I really want to see quickly as well. And then in terms of spine issues, it's definitely any neurologic symptoms that a person may have, meaning, am I having pain that's going down my arm to my hand? Am I having pain that's going down my leg to my foot? Is there numbness and tingling and that sort of stuff? So it's localized neck pain and back pain. I don't get that worked up. I do want to help those people.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones who have associated neurologic sort of signs and symptoms, I definitely
want to
see
them. That's a little issue.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what do you I mean, I know I had, you know, some shoulder issues and came to see you about that, and my knee, obviously, when I had my cellulitis, bursitis combo, and decided to kind of train through that. But I know there were obviously signs and issues where it was like, Jen, you have to go, you know, you have to go to the doctor, you have to come in and see me. Are there certain things that people can do, like workouts or exercises that people should be doing to kind of rehab or prevent any further injury from, you know, especially with the knees and the shoulders, things that we think might, we might be strengthening it, but, kind of things to avoid or do.
Yeah. You know, and you'd have to dig down deep into what the diagnosis is, but speaking in generics or broad strokes, the answer is absolutely yes. Mm-hmm. And I tell my patients when I see them and the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu guys that I work with informally in the gym, you know, you can pay me now or you can pay me later. And that is, you've got to keep up with some sort of preventative maintenance or you're going to be coming back over and over again. For the back, obviously, it's a lot of core strengthening sort of work. And for the neck and shoulder, it turns out that the counterpart to core strengthening in the lower back is called scapular stabilization in the upper back and neck. And it's really just strengthening the muscles between shoulder blades. So anything that pulls the shoulder blades together is going to be helpful for shoulder problems and neck problems, and you need to keep up with it. I definitely practice what I preach. I pretty much in the morning when I wake up, I do some sort of core and scapular stabilization very quickly, and it keeps me on the straight and narrow. And when I'm not doing it, I start to feel aches and pains in those areas.
Well, that's, it doesn't have to take, you know, an hour at the gym of lifting. It could take, you know, 15 minutes.
Definitely.
To put it, but your body's worth it. And if you want to keep obviously practicing the sport or whatever it is, or just living life, you know, without pain, that's something that, you know, you need to incorporate.
I'm going to bring you to clinic with me from now on.
Okay.
Because that's well said. That's exactly
no problem. I can help you out.
You know, so the knee itself is a little bit more tricky because there's not a lot of muscles that surround the knee joint itself. I mean, there's the quadriceps, but that's really above the knee. And so we do want to address quad strength for knee problems, and flexibility of the hamstrings is typically what we do for it. But when there are structural things going on there, sometimes it's beyond that point. So I know you and I share a friend who had, I don't want to do any HIPAA violations.
No. I would have been like, oh, yeah, so-and-so.
Yeah. And so, you know, meniscal injuries, you know, you can strengthen all you want. You're just not going to really make a big difference for that. And sometimes a meniscal injury will kind of peter out and get quiet. So you don't necessarily have to get surgery for it.
Okay.
But it is one of those things that can hover around for a while.
And if you're going to keep using it, I mean, obviously, there's going to come a point that,
you know,
probably.
It's a good question, but I would say more like if you become symptomatic with it and it's recurring symptoms, then I would probably say the writing's on the wall that if you continue doing what you're doing, you're probably going to have to repair that. I mean, that's cartilage. There's just really no strengthening or stretching I can do for that.
Yeah.
And the same thing with, you know, some of the ligamentous stuff that you and I were talking about. If it's a full tear, it's probably going to have to be repaired.
Right.
Partial tears, you can try and strengthen the muscles around it to make up for it.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's a complete tear of the lateral collateral, that ligament that's on the outside, or the ACL, which is the ligament that's on the inside, you know, you're going to have to do something about that.
Right. Now, what do you think? I mean, obviously, I would think stretching and maybe like yoga, things like that would be good for kind of some core strength, flexibility help maintain.
No doubt. You know, because the exercises that you can learn from a therapist can sometimes get mundane. And I think that a lot of my patients fall off the wagon for that very reason. They just, they feel better, number one, and they stop.
Right.
But they also find it boring as could be.
Yeah.
And they stop.
Yeah.
And so I think doing things like Pilates, yoga, Tai Chi, there are ways of kind of addressing those core strengthening and scapular stabilization, but making it interesting. And then if it's interesting, you're more likely to do it. So totally agree.
Awesome. So a lot of people, obviously, who are suffering from a lot of injuries or maybe getting surgery, you know, post-surgery, things like that, we obviously have, and I know a lot of people have heard about lately, this opioid epidemic. You know, and I'm one, I mean, my dad just had a knee replacement and, you know, of course you get the painkillers and Norco and things like that. And I feel like, you know, there's a lot of, obviously somebody needs to heal from a surgery or an injury. But I feel like there is, you know, quite a few refills or you know, like he's not one, he doesn't want to take as many necessarily, but I feel like, you know, they are very kind of available. And I heard recently too that now there's places if you have excess pills where you can bring them in to dispose of them. I think the hospitals or maybe there's facilities where you can do that. But
absolutely.
Can you just touch a little bit on this?
Sure. You know, I'm actually grateful that it's horrible what's going on in the country in terms of the opioid crisis, but I'm very happy that it's come to the forefront because
now
it's on not only the physician's radar, but it's on the government's radar, and its patients are becoming more aware of it as well.
Right.
And so the tide is turning. In fact, there's an initiative called Turning the Tide that, that the Surgeon General put forth in terms of how we should be using these opiates and how we shouldn't be using them. Because a lot of the usage of the opiates prior to this awareness was based on studies on that people had cancer. And so the outcomes were hard to measure because some of these people unfortunately pass away. And so addiction really wasn't a big issue or something that really – or dependence. And so we really thought we were doing the right thing by treating it. And then we extrapolated from those cancer studies, well, if we're treating their pain that way, we should treat your pain that way. And then we started noticing the dependence and the addiction that was associated with it.
Right.
So now we're really at a point where we're trying to educate doctors, educate patients that these medications are meant to be used for short periods of time. And even then, you really should exhaust the non-opiate medications first. And then if it's not working out and a patient just can't do what they need to do in life, then you can use them, but very monitored and for very short periods of time with a game plan to get them off
of it. To get them off.
Exactly. Because dependence can happen as quickly as 3 weeks. People don't know that. And the other thing I hear from my patients and, you know, when I roll my eyes to myself, not in front of them, is, you know, I'm not the type of person that will get dependent or addicted to this. And there may be some personalities and some genetic component to it, but we're all prone to it.
Right.
And so it doesn't matter
if
you're a strong personality, so on and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't even realize it. I mean, I feel like you've seen a lot of athletes or just regular people who become like having, you know, heroin addictions or drug addictions, like it turns into this whole thing from, you know, taking painkillers because of an injury or whatever problem they had.
Yeah, what happens is they get on the medication, they become addicted to the medication. Physicians who are not trained in pain management panic and say, I'm just going to cut you off. And then you abruptly cut someone off like that. They turn to the street. And not only that, sometimes these medications are expensive. And it's another reason because heroin is not expensive.
Right.
And so that's why you're seeing that.
Wow.
It's more accessible and less expensive.
Yeah. I mean, that's scary. I've heard of people, too, that are like, I don't even, like, if they have to have surgery or, you know, have a really tough injury, that their concern is not having the surgery, but it's like getting addicted to the painkillers.
Yeah.
Or the opioids, you know?
I mean, I'll never get addicted because if I even look at those pills, I become constipated. So I have a built-in safety device. So
I know that's
TMI, but I just had to share.
That's amazing. But hey, well, there are some people who get really like nauseous and sick from taking like pain meds and things like that.
It essentially slows down your bowels and it's going to present as one of two ways.
Either
you're not going to go that way or you're going to go that way.
So if you can tolerate that, that's when there's more of an issue of concern, maybe.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh. And I know I said, you know, I even like with my dad, because I don't like taking anything, you know, I'm very like more holistic approach to stuff. Unless I absolutely have to, maybe I'll take some Advil, you know, ibuprofen. But I know I had even said, I kept kind of saying and just digging it in, even though he was fine about it. But I'm like, okay, I know you just had surgery. Yeah. I know you might need these right now, but.
It was his knee or his hip, remind me.
His knee.
It was his knee.
Yes. I mean, he's doing fabulous.
Exactly.
Just saying.
And let's face it. I mean, you just put in a knee.
I cut him a little slack.
Yeah. You made a big incision.
Right.
You took away some bone. You put in a metallic device that he was not born with. So it's reasonable to get that person comfortable so that he can participate in rehab. But just keep your eye on the ball and then, you know, don't just let it run wild. That's all you have to do.
Yeah. And he's like now to the point where I think it's 3 weeks out and he's driving now. He just wants to see the doctor on Monday. And, you know, he's kind of taking it as needed, you know, if he has to.
Right.
And eventually he'll, you know, if he needs to, he can take Advil. But, you know, so that's definitely a good, I think, perspective to have on it is just trying to wean yourself off a little bit when you feel like you don't need it anymore.
Yeah, it's scary when people get again, there's two different words, addicted and dependent. Either way, it's very scary. It's scary for them. It's scary for physicians. It's scary for their family.
Yeah.
And so it's really not to be taken lightly.
Right. I feel like it's definitely a legit concern nowadays where it's something you wouldn't even have thought about. And now it's like, that's one more thing to kind of worry about. And definitely. I feel like too, how often they tell you to take, like it was probably two every like 4 hours. And it's like, well, do you really need that many?
Yeah. And you know, so that's the other thing. It's all about education. You know, patients get the bottle and they see two pills every 4 to 6 hours. It doesn't mean you take it.
No, but I think, a lot of people like my dad, they're going to listen to what the doctor says.
Exactly.
Obviously. And yes, I mean, doctors are amazing. Yeah. So much respect for doctors. But sometimes they may not know, as much about what's...
And they don't take the time to explain to patients, listen, it says every 4 to 6 hours. That doesn't mean you take it every 4 to 6 hours. It means at 4 to 6 hours, if you're in a lot of pain, go ahead and take it.
Right.
But at 4 to 6 hours, if it's minimal, you can grin and bear it or take an Advil instead or ice instead. You're better off doing that than taking that.
And I think that's something that's good if doctors are starting to get more proactive about explaining that.
Yes.
That's good because there are people who will just be like, well, the doctor said this or it's on here. I need to take my meds.
Right. No, this is a partnership. There's no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. The doctors are at fault. Patients are at fault. Patients have to take care of themselves, but doctors have to educate them because that's what the patients are turning to you for. And
exactly.
So it's got to be a two-way street.
Mm-hmm. And then if people out there do have excess like pain medications, you shouldn't really keep it in the house. You can bring it to the hospital?
Yeah, they'll dispose of it. Okay. Pharmacies will do the same thing.
Okay.
But yeah, there's that whole concern of, if you have children in the house and so on and so forth. So yeah, if they're not being used, I would get rid of them. I definitely agree.
And you probably shouldn't just like, oh, I have those pain meds from a year ago.
Yeah,
I'm in pain now. I can just pop one. That's probably not the best.
Yeah, and there's expirations on them. I don't think it's harmful in a sense. They're going to lose their potency as time goes on. And so a lot of people, they're like, well, I have it from 2002.
Right.
I'm going to tap into the old medicine cabinet. It's probably not going to help you very much, but go ahead.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, good. I'm glad we had this conversation because I'm just very passionate about it. And obviously, there was a huge crisis going on and still going on.
Still
and I
going,
think just education is the biggest thing. So to hear it from your perspective is great.
Yeah, it's a frustrating issue. So it's a good thing to talk about and get it out there as much as possible, but it's extremely frustrating.
Yeah. I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure it's I can see it in your face. Like you're like, yes, Jen. Where it's something that's hard to deal with.
Yeah. I mean what'll happen sometimes is, I'll get a patient that shows up in my clinic and they'll just be showing up and say, I've been on this for 10 years and
stop it.
Oh yeah. And they'll say,
and
I'm coming to you because my doctor won't write for it anymore. And I want you to write for it, which puts me in an awkward position because
of course,
all of a sudden I'm just relegated to a person who's writing this prescription for this person on a medication that I philosophically do not support. On the flip side, I can't turn them away because they've been on it that long. I can't just say, dude, you're on your own.
Right. Because
what's going to happen is what we already talked about. They're going to turn to the street or they're going to have severe withdrawal, so on and so forth. So we have to establish a plan. And that plan, it's going to be labor intense. It's
right.
And so it's difficult.
10 years?
Oh, my God. That's putting it mildly. I see it all the time.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They just go from one doctor to the next doctor. And just to get them out of the office, they'll say, here's 2 months, go find another doctor. And then they go to another doctor. And then it's another 2 months and so on and so forth.
That's got to be hard on your conscience, though, to just like give some, like, here, I'm just going to feed your pain addiction.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, go ahead, 10 years later.
You're a legal drug dealer is basically what you are. Yeah. It's bad. It's bad.
Oh, my gosh. So now you're, like, weaning somebody off,
correct.
Their addiction.
Correct.
They go cold turkey. I mean, that's obviously, when they turn to the street and things.
Yeah, my philosophy when I meet with patients is, I'm not going to cut you off cold turkey, but our goal is to get you off this.
Right.
And if we're not making incremental decline in the amount that you're taking, then I'm not the physician for you, and we're going to have to find someone else that is willing to do this. But I'm not willing to do this on an ongoing basis because it's not right. It's not the way to treat pain.
What are some of the bad, I mean, obviously, we, besides possible death, I'm assuming, if, you know, from an addiction. But what are some of like the symptoms and signs of somebody who is an active user or addicted to pain meds?
I mean, they're going to be constantly seeking the medication, and they're going to do whatever they can to get it. And that includes beg, borrow, or steal for
right.
it. And so, you know, we here in Illinois and in other states, there's a monitoring program where you can see if they're getting the prescription from multiple people.
Okay.
And where there's a link on our electronic medical records that it allows us to access that very quickly. And that's a warning sign. You know, if
right.
I have a patient and I see they're getting it from multiple people, and then when I take my history, they're not exactly coming across as telling me that.
Right.
I mean, you know, they're trying to hide something from me, and so that's a red flag right off the bat. And I'll, with that, you know, I will make the recommendation that you see an addiction specialist, because that's
yeah.
aberrant behavior, and you really shouldn't be doing that.
Right. Are there a lot of like other physical things that can start happening to the body from taking?
You know, most of what happens, you know, we were talking about some of the GI symptoms that a person has. Mm-hmm. So they may lose weight just because the GI system itself is slowing down itself.
Mm-hmm.
But most of what you see symptomatically from opiates is kind of the withdrawal sorts
right.
of stuff, and you know, the shakes and you know, it can go as bad as hallucinations if they're off the medication
wow.
long enough. There's really no overt symptoms that you're going to see. I mean, you can look at someone's pupils and they're going to be very pinpoint when they're
right.
on that medication. But other than that, really not. I mean, if they take too much, obviously they're going to kind of be in the somnolent state, very tired, so on and so forth. But apart from that, no.
Okay. So just things to kind of,
just,
you know,
say no.
Just say no. Just say no to pain meds.
Yeah. No, again, it's reasonable.
Yes, obviously.
I mean, you get an abdominal surgery,
yeah.
you're going to be in. I mean,
right.
I had a hernia surgery, and I'm a wimp when it comes to pain. And I took it, but, you know, and you have to take it. But I was only more than happy to get off for reasons we already spoke. I'm not going to belabor that point.
You don't want to go back to talk about that?
No. I think everybody's had enough.
Well, talking about some pain, let's talk about your jiu-jitsu journey.
Yeah.
When did you start? How did you become interested in jiu-jitsu?
I went to Evanston Boxing Club. Every time I mention like an organization, I've done one podcast before,
yeah.
and every time I mention some sort of organization, I feel like someone's going to come after me. I can say everything I want to say, right?
You can say everything you want to say, of
like
course.
I mentioned pizza on the last one.
I know what.
We really went off the rails on the last one.
You can talk about anything you want.
We'll talk about pizza
okay,
a little bit
okay.
later. But anyway, so I started at Evanston Boxing Club just to, because I used, my brother was a Golden Glove boxer, so I was his pinata for years. Years. And so I just wanted to get healthy and do boxing. And then when I was there, Mark Vives, who people in the Chicagoland area are going to know, his brother Miles had a very small program at Evanston Boxing Club.
And okay.
it was just a bunch of Northwestern students. And I was very intimidated. Mm-hmm. And so I did some privates with Miles because I didn't want to kind of
take a class or
yeah
the, right of course
to the lions
yep
all the young Northwestern students, you know, were salivating when I walked in the studio. So I did privates with him for a while, and when I felt like I had a little bit of a base, I started with them, and I just loved it. I felt like I was always into kind of combat sports, but getting in the head, for reasons we can discuss a little bit more as well, was not really something I wanted to do anymore.
Yes.
And so it was a kind of a natural fit for me. I had a judo background, so I had some idea of groundwork. They do mostly stand up, but I had some idea of groundwork. So I just fell in love with it, and I've been with it ever since, and then evolved to working with Jeff and Jeff Serafin. And I continue to do judo with the Coen brothers from time to time. Not as much as I used to, but I continue to do that
every
as
so
well.
Often. Yeah. So, did Jeff then take over the program that Miles had?
So it's funny. Yeah, Mark, you know, just wanted a bigger place and found another place, not the one he's ultimately in now. There was a go between that, and then Jeff Curran. I know.
Oh.
For a short period of time. So I was doing privates with
really?
Jeff Curran for a short period of time.
Okay.
I know. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yes. Fun fact.
Okay. Yeah, for sure. I'm like, wait a minute. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and he's out in Crystal Lake now.
Correct.
Right? Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
So I think the problem, I didn't dig into it, but I think the problem was the commute, and Jeff was thinking about sending some of his other students to teach there. And, mm-hmm. and I think it just fell through. And then Jeff Serafin came in, and then that was great.
Right.
Yeah, and so he was at that Evanston Boxing Club location, and now he's in his other location on Main Street.
Okay. We love Jeff. I mean, Jeff is mentioned a lot in these podcasts.
I'm sure. He's great.
Oh, he's amazing. So how old were you when you started jiu-jitsu?
Well,
it's very inspiring to hear.
I'm 26. When people start. I'm 26 now. No, I'm 54 now. And I started, I'd say 14 years ago.
Okay.
So I was 40.
Yeah.
Yeah, I must have been going through some midlife crisis.
I mean, I was 31 when I started. It's amazing. You know, it's just to spread the love of jiu-jitsu and understand that you can really start at any age is important.
Yeah, so I started jiu-jitsu, got a Porsche and a faux hawk. No.
There was a lot going on at that time in your life.
Exactly. And some bedazzle.
Right. But you stuck with the jiu-jitsu.
Yes. I got rid of the bedazzle.
Everything else. Yeah.
And
yeah.
There's just not enough up there for the faux hawk anymore.
So what's the biggest thing you love about jiu-jitsu? You've obviously stuck with it this long.
Oh, it's the friendships. There's no doubt about that. So mm-hmm. I would say that's the first thing that pops in my head, and that is the thing that I love most and the thing that I miss most when I get an injury. But, I mean, it keeps me in shape. You know, I'm accountable for myself. It's not really a team sport. I mean, it is from a point perspective, but you're responsible for your own destiny. I like setting goals, so I can't compete that much just because of how old I am and the weight that I am. There just doesn't exist that many people to compete against. And so,
but you compete. Come on, I mean, you get out there and compete
usually
at least tournaments
twice a year.
Yeah.
You know, at PANS and Old Man World. I think it's important to set that up because if you have a goal, mm-hmm. you're gonna be more disciplined. And if you're just doing it, it becomes mundane just showing up to the mm-hmm. gym every day. And so I like setting goals, but it's just nice to go there and socialize and see your friends. You know how it is.
Absolutely, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, it's my life. I always say it's the love of my life.
Yes.
Really,
yes.
When I found that, I was like, okay. Everything, get divorced, everything else is over, I have jiu-jitsu.
It's just hard. You know, when you travel, it's not like tennis or golf where you can just go play. It's just, you know, if you go somewhere, you got to find someone else that can put the gear on.
Yeah, for sure.
It's not always easy to do.
Absolutely.
But no, I do love it.
Have you had any jiu-jitsu injuries?
Well, I have a bad back, and it definitely got resurrected during my years of doing jiu-jitsu, which is why I'm now much more religious about my core strengthening and scapular mm-hmm. stabilization that I do every morning. And I've been doing, knock on wood, pretty well in that regard. My knee is bothering me a little bit. I have a very small meniscal tear, and so that kind of wakes up every now and again. And I think those are the biggies. So it's mostly spine and knee for me.
Okay.
But I you know, I listen to my body, and I'm dead. Like I said, I practice what I preach. I keep up with the exercise. You got to do it.
Absolutely. You need to stay healthy to, you know, continue training. I mean, I think the goal, especially for everybody in jiu-jitsu, is to train as long as we can.
Yes.
And forever. And
yes.
Probably in a lot of different sports as well. But so doing these other, you know, training sessions and things are very important.
I think the thing that is least receptive, and everyone can appreciate this, but, you know, people will come up to me informally in the clinic, the gym. I'm using those words interchangeably. and I'll say, you know, when I'll examine them and I'll come up with what I think is going on in that setting. And, you know, and when you say to them, you got to take a teeny bit of a break here and you've got to take, you know, start these exercises, you know. Mm-hmm.
It that word break is very hard to swallow.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's like telling someone, you know, you got to go rob this bank.
Right.
They don't want to hear it.
And
I'm like, okay, then don't take a break. And,
right.
And it's only a matter of time that I hear from them again.
Yeah. It's going to be where, I mean, taking that time off, and I tell people too, and I try and practice this, but rest and recovery is as much a part of training as actually getting on the mats and rolling and drilling and doing your functional training and all of that. But it's like you have to take, your body has to have time to recover.
Yeah.
And sometimes taking a little bit of a break,
no doubt,
for a short time is much better than being out for
And you can
6 months.
And you can even downshift. I mean, you can practice guard retention if you have a shoulder injury. And
right, exactly. Can, change so, up, yeah, exactly, the training.
Exactly. And yeah, you can find easy people to roll with and just kind of flow roll. So there's lots of ways to skin a cat. You don't necessarily have to just sit on the sidelines. Yeah.
Right, yeah, exactly. So what are some, what are like one of the craziest injuries you've ever seen? I guess it doesn't have to be jujitsu related. It could be just in your 23 years.
Oh, no, we can stick with jujitsu. Yeah, I was the physician for, I think it was a Naga event. It wasn't an IBJJF. And they called, you know, I heard my name being called to one of the mats, you know, Dr. Joe, come to mat 8 or whatever it was. And this person's patella was, the kneecap was... totally not where it was supposed to be.
Stop it.
I mean,
really?
It was not even close to where it was supposed to be.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It was gross.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So what did... I can't even imagine the amount of pain. I mean, I know the adrenaline is probably, but...
He was writhing. And then you can try and reduce it on the mat, meaning put it back into place. And we tried, but he...
Oh.
It was blood shrilling scream that he was doing, and I said, "All right, you gotta go." And then they came, and what they do is they in the emergency room they can sedate him heavily and get him to relax, and then it'll pop back into place.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, but I don't know if you knew this, but I used to cover the UFC when it came to Chicago.
I actually on the Grappler Union podcast, yeah. I think you talked so about that maybe
covered,
a little bit.
I think I covered like 3 fights.
Okay,
I covered the very first fight that came here.
Really?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of who it was. It may have been Anderson Silva. Was
oh wow
when he fought Cote.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was fun. It was, you know, each one became less fun. Because the UFC, again, I'm having a feeling like Dana White's going to call me tomorrow and sue me for what I'm about to say.
But they
But they have their own consulting physician that travels with them. So these physicians are not licensed in the state, but they're his kind of right-hand men.
Right.
And they're breathing down your neck during the fight, telling you what you should be doing. And so, you know, most physicians are autonomous by nature. They want to make their own decisions. They don't want somebody breathing down their neck. Not in an arrogant way, but you just have your own practice philosophies. And so that...
Well, and I can imagine if you see something that's like...
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Let me do this, man. That's
right.
My watch, not on your watch.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be the one held accountable. So I'm going to make a decision here. But thank you very much for your input.
Right.
So that was the annoying aspect of it. And it was... barely noticeable in the original fight that I did. And the second one, it became a little bit more apparent. And then the third one, it was just downright overbearing. And I said, that's going to do it for me. So that was that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I can't even imagine being in that atmosphere. I mean, you have an understanding, obviously, a little bit, you know, of what's going on being, you know, a jiu-jitsu practitioner. But, I mean, wow. Yeah. There's got to be some crazy stuff that happens.
And so I'd cover, being associated with Illinois State Commissioner, I would cover professional boxing matches.
Yeah.
And then some of the other, you know, Bellator came through. I covered a couple of those. And then XFO, I don't know if it's still in existence. It's kind of a...
I don't know.
It's
kind
of a local MMA organization that I think Jeff Kern was involved with. And so I used to cover a lot of theirs. And I like those because... you know, there is no one there breathing down your neck. You're kind of doing it on your own. And I think that the fighters appreciate me because I have at least the Brazilian jiu-jitsu background. So they know that I'm understanding of what their passions are and injuries they can potentially have. Because you have to do the physical the night before, and then you're at the fight the night of.
Right.
And you know, you're overseeing things. And there's been a couple of instances where I saw someone go unconscious from a submission prior to the ref seeing it. And so I was able to, you know, kind of intervene and get the fight stopped. So it was good stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think, that's the amazing thing about knowing you and the fact that you do jiu-jitsu is I think people can just relate to you so much easier, you know, and it's like, okay, he really does understand. He's not just a doctor, like telling me whatever, like he knows this, he knows the grind, he understands, you know, all the pain and the injuries and the potential of things happening. So I think it's great that, I mean, I know we can probably get annoying at times
myself.
I'm always like, okay, I'm going to text Dr. Joe. I don't know if I should do that. I'm probably probably just annoying him, but
no. I enjoy help. I mean, I view the jiu-jitsu community as family, and so I enjoy helping it. I said it on the previous podcast, and and my techs have gone through the roof. No, I'm just kidding, but but I enjoy helping, and if people, you know, have the faith in me to help them out, that's an honor. So
absolutely,
yeah.
Yes, we all love you. We all, you know, turn to you. So
thank you.
I think that's you. We trust you. I'm like, whatever he says, then it's okay.
You know, sometimes I get asked questions that I don't know the answer to. And, right. So we've got to keep it to sports medicine and spine.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, I get asked other questions. Again, we'll keep it clean.
Yes.
But, you know, I'll do my best.
But it's good, too, because, you know, you've referred, obviously, you know, when things are going on, it's great to know you to be able to refer or know, like, what doctors are good or not, you know, to refer kind of to other people for other problems ailments or things like that.
If I don't know it, I can help figure out who will know it.
Exactly.
And so, yeah, no, I know. I'm happy to do that as well.
So what's this about pizza?
Oh, no, they asked me. They asked me because I'm from New York. Uh-huh. So they asked me, they said Chicago pizza or New York pizza.
Mm-hmm.
And I like Chicago pizza.
And you say that like, oh, I like it. But
I don't want to get jumped on the way out of here today.
You're in the home like WGN.
Yeah, I really like it. So they were talking, meaning the Grappler Union guys were talking about this Pequod's, and I've never heard. Do you know this place?
I've heard of it. I've never been.
Yeah,
people
exactly.
are probably going to be like, "Oh my God, you guys, really?"
No, exactly. Yeah. And when I said I never heard of it, they almost threw one of the mics at me. And so now I've heard of it, but I still haven't been there yet. But I really do. I want to go. I really want to go. I want to try it.
Okay.
But I like thick crust. I like it. It's a little decadent, but I like it.
See, I'm a thin crust girl. I don't know. It's the Italian. I just thin crust, crispy.
But do you like the ones where they're cut into like the little squares and stuff? I don't like that. I like the big triangles. Floppy.
Yeah. I'll do either. I don't discriminate.
I see.
Yeah. So I don't eat pizza often.
No.
But when I do, it has to be thin crust, really good fresh ingredients. And
do you like thin crust because you feel like you're taking on too many calories from the big, thick crust?
Well, yeah, part of me would say yes.
I'm trying to get everyone in the audience hungry. Big,
right.
thick crust. Melty cheese.
I do feel like it's a little less guilty.
Yes.
But I like the crunch. I just like I like the texture better.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's more about the overall just taste. And I think too, when like going to Italy and having pizza there, it's like super thin, fresh, good. Like, so that's kind of what I like.
Yes.
Versus the really
You've
thick.
Been to Italy.
Yes.
You've been
And
to
you haven't.
I haven't. I know.
Which
is it,
I it's know. Crazy to me.
I know.
Just saying.
It's bad. It's bad.
I mean, it's been 11 years since I've been. But yes, we have family there and everything. So,
no, but I feel like if you're going to go, you have to spend time there. Meaning you can't just, it's not like I'm going to go for a long weekend or something like that.
No, you have to go, I mean, at least bare minimum a week. But exactly. Like 2 weeks would be
perfect.
The best.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't have 2 weeks.
You should find some time at some point. I mean, I know everyone needs you here, but it's incredible.
Yeah.
And then taste the pizza out there, and then we can have this conversation again.
Yes. We'll do another podcast.
Yes, exactly. All about pizza.
The pizza
we can
podcast.
Talk about healthy alternatives about pizza. I can
exactly.
chime in for that.
Exactly.
But is there anything else that you kind of want to cover? Any other tips or anything?
Yeah, I think the big buzz, and I get a lot of questions on, is plasma-rich injections, PRP.
Okay.
So kind of the jury's still out on it. The evidence on it isn't overwhelming. There's some real positive studies, and then there's some studies that are equivocal, meaning that doesn't say yes, doesn't say no.
So this is the like stem cell, right?
Or
is
this different? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Basically, they take your blood. And the idea is they take it, they put it in a centrifuge where they spin it out, and then the plasma-rich protein substance that comes out has growth factors in it, your own growth factors. So,
okay.
So you're really not going to have a reaction to it. And the thought is by putting those growth factors in an affected joint will promote some sort of regeneration. Like, for example, if you have a torn meniscus, rather than getting meniscus surgery, maybe you can do this and it'll help some of that cartilage heal on its own, because cartilage and ligament has poor blood supply and by nature does not heal very well.
Okay.
And so some half and half studies for the knees, and because they're half and half, it's not reimbursed, so it's extremely
expensive. I was going to say, that's not covered.
Mm-mm.
No.
No,
and yeah, because like, I know a few people who have done it, a few jiu-jitsu athletes.
Yeah.
And I think it was for the knees.
Yeah. What'd they say?
They seem to be doing well with it.
I see.
That it was really good, but that was one of the things I think they had some kind of relationship with somebody or were able to, you know, get it done. But I know that it is expensive.
$3,000 on the average. That's a lot of pizza.
Yeah, that is. Holy cannoli.
Yeah.
That's a lot. I mean...
Who's got that?
$3,000
to do on something that may or may not work.
I
mean, I'll spend $3,000 on something that has a high percentage yield.
Absolutely.
But I'm not so sure I'm going to do it with the statistics that exist right now. Yeah.
So what about, as you talk about injections, what other common injections are there? Like, I mean, obviously cortisone.
Yeah. Yeah. So I do a lot of those. I do a lot of cortisone injections for the spine, which are all x-ray guided. So they're safe and easy to do. They don't help everyone. When they do help, it's great. And when they don't help, I don't recommend repeating it. And there are people that say, let's try it again.
And how many, I was going to say, do you do it kind of once? If it doesn't work, you're not going to do it again?
Yeah. I mean, patients get mad at me. They want me to do it. In previous days, before we did them under x-ray, they were done blindly. And by doing them blindly, which is, I mean, if you stop and think about it, a pregnant female will get it done blindly because you can't expose the fetus to x-ray. But it's pretty easy to tell that you're in the right spot with someone who's in labor because they're going to be calling you every name in the book if you're not in place. So eventually you're going to...
So that's an easy guide.
Yeah, exactly.
Right there.
Exactly. When they stop cursing me, I know that I've gotten in the right spot. But for the person who has a pinched nerve, you know, doing it blindly, the miss rate is 30%. So in the old days... they used to do what's called a series of three, meaning we'll just try it three times. Because statistically speaking, if you do that three times, your odds of getting in the right place
significantly
improve. It goes down to something like 5% or something like that.
Okay.
So that's why they always repeat it. So if someone came back and said it didn't work, and they could say, well, maybe we didn't get in. Let's do it again. Let's do it again. So we don't do that series of three anymore. Because when you do it under x-ray, there is no missing. I can see it in live time, real time, that I was in the right spot. And going back there again is not going to help. Now, if a patient comes to me and I do the shot and they say, I'm about 30% better, but I still can't get back to doing jiu-jitsu, for example, because the pain is still too much, that's the type of person I'll repeat it. And I'll try and get a cumulative effect.
Mm-hmm.
On the flip side, if I get a good response, in other words, if a patient comes back and says, I'm 80% there, I'm really not going to stick a needle in their spine again for another 20%. I think that now that a majority of the pain is gone, it'll get better with the rehab program. And so that's how I treat it. If it doesn't help at all, no, I'm not going to repeat it. If it helps a little, then we'll repeat it. And if it helps a lot, then we'll let nature take its course.
Okay.
So that's how I do it.
Okay. Because I know, I mean, I've heard obviously so many mixed reviews. Some people are like, oh, it's definitely helped, or they're trying it. It's kind of a last resort before the rehab, or if they're at the point where they might have to have surgery on something and they want to try the shot.
It's going to help about 70% of people. So it has a pretty established track record. But doesn't help 30%. That's not a small number. That's one in three people are not going to respond. But it's worth trying, because doing it under x-ray, the only risk that you're taking on for the most part is infection and bleeding, which is the same as having blood drawn. And so it's a very low risk procedure. The amount of x-ray that's used is minimal. I'm starting to glow in the dark because I've been doing so many of them, but my patients don't. Yeah.
Like, my patients are fine. Me, on the other hand.
Exactly.
I don't know.
I'll take the bullet for you.
Yeah. So that's good. Okay, that's good to know. Because I always did hear it was like three times. Like, you have three options, you know, to get it done, or chances, I should say. But now that it's a little bit more
guided. Yeah. And then in terms of the most common question I get is this going to deteriorate my spine? And so if you're doing, first of all, you can do up to three in a year, and it's really not going to have deleterious, a bad effect on you. It's not going to erode at your bones or ligaments, so on and so forth. But if you're someone who's young and active and you're doing that three times a year every year, you really got to rethink your strategy.
Right.
And so that's if I have a patient who's 80 years old mm-hmm. and they're not going to do their home exercise program, you really can't put them on medications because they're already on a lot of medications.
Right.
I think that's a realistic thing to do to keep their pain under control. I'll do it 3 times a year and I'll do it like clockwork to help them have quality of life. But if someone your age was coming to me and you were like, Joe, it's back again. Let's do it again. Joe, it's back again. Let's do it again. Joe, it's back.
Right.
It's not a sustainable strategy.
No.
And I'm not going to condone it. I'm going to say, Jen,
absolutely.
You got to either you're not doing your home exercise program, you're not keeping up with your end of the deal, or maybe you do need surgery for this if you're relying on this so much.
Right. Yeah, you would definitely have to. I mean, it's almost like just a Band-Aid.
Right.
You know,
at that point.
In a sense. Yeah.
Yeah. At that point. Doing it over and over again. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's good to know. All this information is
I'm trying
amazing.
To be a wealth of knowledge.
I mean, you you are. If there's not anything else,
we
miss anything?
No.
I think we got everything that we needed to cover.
Yes.
For now, until we need to have you back again.
Yeah, and I didn't say, she told me I couldn't say any curses, and I did a really good job. And
you did great. I appreciate that.
I have like a thumbtack in my shoe to prevent me from saying things. So I'm really proud of myself in that regard.
I'm very proud, too. I appreciate it so much.
And my mom would be proud.
Yes. And I really do appreciate you taking the time
to come
down today.
Love it.
You know, it's going to be super helpful for a lot of people. And where can people find you, if that's okay? Maybe email you if they have questions or need to set up an appointment or something. So
I'm a social media maven. She's laughing and correctly so. But nonetheless, I do respond to Messenger. Once I figure out that little icon has a message there. That's probably the easiest way of getting me. But, people get my email and they email me and I have no problem with that. I don't view that as intrusive. Like I said, if someone has faith in me, I'm honored to help them as much as I can, informally or formally.
What's your email address?
It's jlever@northshore.org
because
I work at North Shore, which is Evanston, Glenbrook, which are the two hospitals I work at, but it's also affiliated with Highland Park and Skokie.
Excellent.
And so I see patients only at Evanston and Glenbrook.
Okay. So you're very accessible.
Yes.
So that's great.
Yes. Okay. So you can come see me as well. But like I said, if time is an issue and you just want to bounce something off of me, you can definitely do that.
Excellent. Well, thank you again. And all of you guys know, any questions or topics you have or that you want to hear us discuss, you can email me at gettingzenwithjenz@gmail.com. See you next week. Bye.